Chapter 33. "What do you mean the ship has yet to materialize?" Gunn rasped in dismay. The section chief of the FBI's International Terrorism Operations, a compact man named Tyler, opened a file on his desk and perused the contents as he spoke. "We've had no information on the whereabouts of the cable ship Byakje. The Japanese National Police Agency has been monitoring shipping traffic in every port in the country, physically checking every ship that remotely resembles the description offered by your NUMA crew. They've come up empty so far." "Have you checked ports outside of Japan?" "An international notice has been posted with Interpol, and it is my understanding that the CIA has been asked to provide inputs at the request of the Vice President. At this time, no confirming information has been received. There's a million places she could be hiding, Rudy. Or she could have been scuttled herself." "What about satellite imagery of the site where Sea Rover was sunk?"
"Bad timing there, unfortunately. With the recent flare-up of political tensions in Iran, the National Reconnaissance Office has repositioned several of its high-resolution imaging resources to the Middle East. The East China Sea is one of many dead spots right now that is only covered by periodic scans from non-geosynchronous satellites, which all means that the Byakje could move 500 miles between covering passes. I'm waiting for the historical images from the last few days, but have been told not to be too hopeful." Gunn's anger softened as he realized that the slightly balding G-man in the starched white shirt was a competent professional doing the best with the resources he had available. "Any headway on the ship's history?" he asked.
"Your man Hiram Yeager gave us a good head start on that one. Yeager was the one who tentatively identified the ship as the Byakje, based on a worldwide review of ship registries through his NUMA computer bank. Apparently, there are less than 40 known cable-laying ships of the size and configuration reported by your NUMA-rescued crew. We narrowed the list down to 12 that were owned or leased in the Asia-Pacific region, and the Byakje came up missing in action." The FBI man paused as he leafed through the folder before extracting a white sheet that carried the blurred markings of a fax copy across its header. "Here we are. Details of the vessel. Cable-laying ship Byakje, 445 feet long, gross tonnage of 9,500. Built by the Hyundai Mipo Dockyard Company Limited, Ulsan, South Korea in 1998. Owned and operated by Kang Shipping Enterprises, Incheon, South Korea from 1998 to 2000. Since 2000, ship has been under lease to the Nippon Telegraph and Telephone Corporation, Tokyo, Japan, for cable-laying services in and around the Sea of Japan." Setting the folder down, he stared straight into the eyes of Gunn. "NTT's operating lease expired 6 months ago, at which time the Byakje sat unutilized in a Yokohama dock. 2 months ago, representatives from NTT renegotiated a one-year lease of the ship and took possession of the vessel with their own crew. Port records show she was unaccounted for during a five-week period, then appeared briefly back in Yokohama approximately 3 weeks ago. She was believed sighted in Osaka, where she apparently tailed the Sea Rover to the East China Sea."
"Was the ship seized from NTT?"
"No. NTT officials were shocked to learn that their name was on a revised lease agreement for the vessel, since their fiber optic cable route had been completed. The NTT corporate representatives that leased the ship were, in fact, imposters, who buffaloed the Kang shipping agents. The Kang people produced the paperwork. Everything looked legitimate to them, though one representative thought it odd at the time that the NTT people were providing their own crew, which they had not done in the past. The Kang shipping people are apparently scrambling to file an insurance claim on the vessel now."
"Sounds like there must have been some inside information somewhere. Any known links between the Japanese Red Army and Nippon Telegraph and Telephone?"
"None that we've established yet, but we're looking into it. NTT's executives are cooperating fully and seem eager to clear their name from a possible connection. Official corporate sponsorship looks unlikely, so the Japanese authorities are focusing on a possible employee faction somewhere within the company." Gunn shook his head discouragingly.
So we've got a 400-foot ship that has vanished into thin air, a U.S. government vessel that has been sunk, and an empty list of suspects. Two of my people have been kidnapped, possibly murdered, and we have no idea where to even look for them.
We're frustrated too, Rudy, but we'll get them eventually. Sometimes these things just take time.
Time, Gunn thought. Just how much time did Dirk and Summer still have, if any at all? The hot shower felt delicious. Summer let the steaming water pelt her body for more than 20 minutes before finally willing herself to turn off the shower control knobs and reach for a towel. It had been nearly 4 days since her last bout with cleanliness, she mentally calculated, rerunning over in her mind the events of the last few days. Stepping from the marble-tiled shower, she dried herself with a fluffy towel, then wrapped the fabric around her body, tucking the loose end under an armpit. Before her stretched an immense marble counter with double sinks and gleaming gold fixtures set beneath an expansive beveled mirror that stretched to the high ceiling. You had to give these unsmiling thugs some credit, she thought. Someone around here has taste. After an uncomfortable night's sleep in the motor yacht, where she and her brother took turns sleeping on the twin bed with their hands cuffed behind their back, a trio of armed guards marched them ashore in the morning. Peering at the massive residence perched on the stone bluff above them, Dirk remarked, "Kind of reminds you of the Berghoff, doesn't it?" The stone structure with the commanding view over the Han River did bear a passing resemblance to Hitler's vacation lair in the German Alps. The image was made all the more complete with the surrounding array of black-shirted henchmen. Prodded to the rock-enveloped elevator, they rode up to an interior corridor level beneath the main quarters and were escorted to a pair of guest rooms. In rough English, a guard barked, "Prepare for dining with Mr. Kang. 2 hour." While Summer showered, Dirk surveyed his plushly decorated adjoining room for a potential means of escape. The windowless rooms were dug into the face of the cliff, the only entry or exit being the corridor hall, where two armed guards stood in front of each room's open door. If they were going to make an escape, it probably wasn't going to happen here, he figured. As Summer dried her wet hair, she briefly became lost in the luxury and allowed herself to enjoy the surroundings. She sniffed at an array of exotic lotions and perfumes aligned on the marble counter, settling on an aloe vera body lotion and a lilac-scented fragrance. A rack of silk clothing stood in the corner, a conspicuous offering for female guests. Running her fingers through the brightly colored collection of petite-sized robes and dresses, she spotted a flaming red pullover dress with matching short jacket that looked like it might fit. Squirming into the silk dress, she eyed herself in the mirror and admired the results. A little tight in the bust, but a fair representation of a China doll, albeit tall and red-haired, she thought, smiling at the reflected image. Finding an assortment of shoes at the foot of the rack, she rummaged through a dozen pair before finding a black set of low-heeled flats that fit. Wedging the shoes on, she cursed as a thumbnail cracked while tugging at a heel. Instinctively, she rummaged through the bathroom counter, bypassing combs and brushes before discovering one of a woman's essentials, an emery board. Not a cheap cardboard version, the metal file sported a small, flat porcelain handle. Admiring the tiny tool, she absently stuck it in a side pocket after smoothing her thumbnail. An instant later, a pounding at the room door indicated her interval of private luxury was over. Exiting the room into the corridor at gunpoint, Summer found Dirk standing casually with two rifle muzzles pointed at his back. He looked at his sister in the stunning silk dress and let fly a wolf's whistle. "I'm afraid we've only got a few rats to guide your chariot tonight, Cinderella," he joked, tossing his thumb in the direction of the two guards behind him. "I see you've decided to stick with the Mr. Goodwrench look," she countered, observing that he wore the same grease- and sweat-stained Numa jumpsuit he'd worn since they were abducted. "Afraid my available wardrobe was a little on the short side," he said, pulling the cuffs of his jumpsuit up to mid-calf range for emphasis. Never did care much for the alfalfa sartorial look. The four guards grew annoyed with their chattering and forcefully guided them to the elevator, where they rode silently up one floor.
The doors opened on Kang's impressive dining room, with the broad vista shimmering through the picture windows. Kang sat at the head of the dining table, quietly reviewing the contents of a leather-bound folder, while Tong Ju stood erect off his left shoulder. The Korean magnate looked the part of an industrial captain, attired in a custom-fitted navy blue suit from an expensive Hong Kong tailor, with complimentary maroon silk tie. His steely slate eyes darted towards the elevator briefly, then returned to the documents before him, his face a mask of cold austerity. Dirk and Summer were escorted to the table, where their eyes briefly drank in the scenic riverscape view through the window before settling on their captor host. They both mentally noted how the cove below was fed by a narrow, winding inlet that led to the wide river in the distance. Standing before the table, Summer felt a chill run up her spine as Tong Ju shot her a lascivious look, while Kang peered up coldly. Her minor gaiety at being clean and finely dressed withered away in the palpable presence of evil. She suddenly felt foolish in the silken outfit and subconsciously clasped her hands in front of her waist in nervous fear. But her anxiety diminished after she glanced over at Dirk. If her brother felt any fear, he didn't show it. Dirk stood tall with his chin thrust out defiantly, yet carried a bored-with-it-all look on his face. He seemed to enjoy peering down with derision at Tong Ju, who stood nearly 10 inches shorter. The assassin paid no heed and instead spoke directly to his boss. "The submersible operators from the Numa vessel," he said with a touch of disdain. "Daijong Kang," Dirk retorted, ignoring Tong Ju. "CEO of Kang Enterprises." Kang nodded slightly, then motioned for Dirk and Summer to sit down. The guards eased back to a side wall where they kept a vigilant watch over the two captives, while Tong Ju slid into a chair opposite Dirk. "Mr. Pitt here was responsible for the death of our two men in America," Tong Ju said, his eyes narrowing on Dirk. Dirk nodded in mute satisfaction. It was as he suspected, the clear connection between the salvage efforts on both Japanese submarines, as well as the murder attempt on Vashon Island. "A small world," Kang replied. "Too small for mass murderers like you," Summer hissed in a low voice, her anger taking rise. Kang ignored the comment. "A pity. The men in Seattle were among Tong Ju's top agents." "A tragic accident, really," Dirk replied. "You must learn to recruit employees with better driving skills," he added, his cold glance at Tong Ju met by an equally frigid stare back. "Fortuitous indeed, as we otherwise may have lost your generous assistance in salvaging the I-411, Kang said. "I am most curious as to what led you to the submarines." "Luck, mostly. I discovered that an earlier Japanese submarine had launched a few cyanide shells at the Oregon coast and wondered if someone had recovered some similar shells and used them in the Aleutians. It wasn't until I dove on the I-403 and discovered the remains of the aerial biological bombs that it became evident that there was something more afoot." "A shame that the bombs were damaged during the vessel's sinking," Kang said. "They would have been much easier to recover than those from the I-411. "But you did recover one bomb canister intact, which you discharged in the Aleutian Islands." Kang showed a hint of surprise at Dirk's remark. "Of course," he replied. "Rather interesting how the Japanese combined a chemical and biological agent in one weapon. Our test release revealed that the efficacy of the biological agent was hampered by the dual release, although the chemical component was more potent than we anticipated." "Potent enough to kill 2 U.S. Coast Guardsmen," Summer commented. Kang shrugged. "How did you come to have such a focus with the death of 2 sailors in the Aleutians? Were you there?" Summer shook her head in silence. Then Dirk spoke up. "I was piloting the helicopter that your fishing trawler shot down." Kang and Tong Ju looked at each other with suspicious eyes. "You are rather a resilient man, Mr. Pitt," Kang finally stated. Before he could respond, a side door swayed open and two men in white waiter's jackets glided over to the table, hoisting large silver trays above their shoulders. A colorful array of seafood dishes was spread before each place setting, followed by a glass of Veuve Clicquot champagne. Dirk and Summer, having not eaten a full meal in days, calmly attacked the food as the probing conversation continued.
"Your government is rather displeased with the Japanese, I suspect," Kang prodded.
"Your shady activities under the guise of the Japanese Red Army was a clever ruse, but uncovered for what it was by my government. Your two flunky hitmen were easily traced to Korea," Dirk lied, grinning at Tong Ju. "I suspect the authorities will be banging on your door any minute now, Kang." A brief look of agitation on Kang's brow suddenly softened.
"A commendable effort. But the truth is that the two men had no idea themselves who their employer was. No, I think it is apparent that you know nothing of our intent."
The long-standing animosity of Korea towards Japan for their many years of brutal colonization is well known, Dirk said, continuing the pretext. "It would be no surprise to expect the warped minds possessing these type of weapons to use them on a historical adversary, which in your case is the Japanese." A thin smile crossed Kang's lips, and he sat back in his chair with satisfaction, less from the meal than from Dirk's words.
"A nice bluff, Mr. Pitt.
The fact that your Numa vessel was neither armed nor escorted during the salvage operation tells me that your country did not think much of your discovery on the I-403. And your presumptive guess as to the operative use of the biological weapons is quite off the mark."
"What exactly is your intended use of the weapons?" Summer stammered.
"Perhaps your own country," Kang teased as the color drained from Summer's face.
"Or perhaps not. That is neither here nor there.
The smallpox vaccine is readily available in the United States in quantities sufficient to vaccinate the entire population," Dirk countered. "Tens of thousands of health workers have already been inoculated. A release of the smallpox virus might create a minor panic at best. Certainly, there's not much risk of creating an epidemic."
"Certainly, a release of variola major or common smallpox would register only a small nuisance. But your vaccinations would be useless against a chimera."
"A chimera?" "Of Greek lore. A monster part lion, part goat, and part serpent."
"Indeed. Another monster, if you will, would be a hybrid mix of virulent agents combined into a single organism that maintains the lethal components of each element. A biological weapon against which your vaccinations would be laughably impotent."
"But in God's name, why?" Summer cried. Kang calmly finished his meal and set his napkin on the table, folding it into neat thirds before speaking.
"You see, my country has been divided against itself since your incursion in the 1950s. What you Americans fail to understand is that all Koreans dream of the day when our peninsula is united as one nation. Constant interference from outside meddlers will keep us from achieving that dream. Just as the presence of foreign military forces on our soil creates an impediment to the day when unification becomes a reality. The American military presence in South Korea ensures that the dream of unification will not be realized at the point of a North Korean bayonet," Dirk replied.
"South Korea no longer has the stomach for a fight, and the military power of North Korea offers the leadership and stabilizing force necessary to restore order during reunification."
"I don't believe it,"
Summer muttered to Dirk. "We're having lunch with a cross between Typhoid Mary and Joseph Stalin." Kang, not understanding the remark, continued speaking. "The young people of South Korea today have had their fill of your military occupation and abuses to the citizenry.
They are not fearful of unification and will help pave the way for a speedy resolution. In other words, once the U.S. military is removed, the forces of North Korea will march south and unify the country by force. Absent the U.S. defensive forces, military estimates suggest that 80% of the South Korean peninsula can be overrun within 72 hours. Casualties will be necessary, but the country will be unified under Workers' Party rule before the United States, Japan, or any other outside interfering force has the opportunity to react. Dirk and Summers sat in stunned silence. Their fears of a terrorist plot using the Japanese smallpox had been well-founded, but they had no suspicion of the magnitude at stake. No less than the overthrow of the Republic of Korea in conjunction with the wholesale death of millions of Americans. I think you may be underestimating the resolve of the United States, particularly in the face of a terrorist attack. Our president has shown no hesitation in applying swift and fearsome retribution, Dirk said. Perhaps. But retribution against whom? The pattern of events all still points to a Japanese source. The Japanese Red Army again, Dirk interjected. The Japanese Red Army. You see, there simply are no other likelihoods. Your military, intelligence, and political resources will be focused entirely on Japan, while at the same time, we will be mandating through our government the removal of all U.S. military personnel from the Korean Peninsula within 30 days. Your country's knee-jerk media will be in a frenzy over the epidemic casualties and so focused on finding a culprit in Japan that the American military expulsion from Korea will be a minor news item until well after the fact. The intelligence community will ultimately see past the Red Army facade and trace the actions back to you and your communist pals up north. Perhaps. But how long will that take? How long has it been for your government to solve the 2001 anthrax killings in your own capital? When and if that day should come, emotions will no longer be running high. It will all be a moot point, as you say. Killing millions of people and calling it moot? Summer injected. You are sick. How many of my countrymen did you kill in the 1950s? Kang retorted with a flash of anger in his eyes. We left plenty of our own blood on your soil, Summer replied, glaring back at Kang. Dirk peered across the table at Tongju, whose dark eyes were narrowly focused on Summer. The assassin was not accustomed to people speaking belligerently to Kang, and most certainly not a woman. While his face remained expressionless, a piqued intolerance oozed from his gaze. "Aren't you overlooking your own business interests?" Dirk said to Kang, deflecting the tone. "Your industrial profits won't continue to accrue if the almighty State Workers' Party suddenly takes the reins." Kang smiled weakly. "You Americans, always the capitalists at heart. As it is, I have already arranged the sale of half my holdings to a French conglomerate with payment in Swiss francs. And when my homeland is reunited, who better to help manage the state control of South Korea's industrial resources than myself?" he said arrogantly. "A tidy arrangement," Dirk replied. "A pity there won't be a nation around that will be interested in purchasing the ill-gotten goods of a totalitarian regime." "You forget China, Mr. Pitt. A huge market in and of itself, as well as a friendly conduit for funneling goods to the world markets. There will, of course, be a business interruption during the transfer of power, but output will quickly recover. There is always a demand for inexpensive, quality products." "Sure," Dirk said sarcastically. "Name me one quality consumer product that ever came out of a communist country." "Face it, Kang, you're on the losing end of a new global authority.
There's no longer room for warped despots who screw their own countrymen for personal wealth, military might, or grand delusions of greatness. You and your buddies in the North might have a few laughs along the way, but at the end of the day, you'll all be steamrolled by a concept foreign to you called freedom. Kang sat stiffly for a moment, a long look of annoyance settling over his face.
Thank you for the civics lesson. It has been a most enlightening meal. Goodbye, Miss Pitt. Goodbye, Mr. Pitt, he said coldly.
With a glance to the side wall by Kang, the guards were instantly upon them, pulling the two to their feet. Dirk had thoughts of grabbing a dinner knife off the table and having a go at the guards, but was dissuaded when he saw Tong Ju pointing a Glock pistol at his chest.
Take them to the river cave, Kang barked.
Thanks for the warm hospitality, Dirk muttered at Kang. I look forward to returning the privilege.
Kang said nothing, nodding at the guards instead, who forcibly pushed the pair towards the elevator. Dirk and Summer glanced at each other with a knowing look. Their time was short now. If they were to make it out of Kang's grasp alive, they would have to act soon. The immediate problem was Tong Ju and his Glock 22. Any resistance would be futile while the assassin kept his gun aimed at them, as there was little doubt he would use it without hesitation. Tong Ju followed the four guards as they herded Dirk and Summer to the elevator, his pistol still drawn. As the doors slid open, two pairs of hands shoved them forcefully to the rear of the elevator. Tong Ju barked something in Korean and then, to Dirk's relief, remained standing in the dining hall with one of the guards, a menacing look of satisfaction on his face as the elevator doors slid shut. The elevator was cramped with five bodies in it, which would work to their advantage. Dirk glanced at Summer and nodded ever so slightly, his sister acknowledging the silent message with a quick wink. She immediately grabbed her stomach and groaned, leaning forward as if she were about to vomit. The nearest guard, a chunky man with a shaved head, took the bait and bent down slightly toward Summer. Like a cat mistakenly pouncing onto a hot stove, she suddenly sprang her body upright, jerking her knee into the man's groin with all the might she could muster. The man's eyes nearly burst out of their sockets as her knee hit home and he doubled over in agony, a shriek of pain quivering from his lips. Summer's move was all Dirk needed to neutralize guard number two. As all three guards' attention turned initially to Summer, he launched an uppercut that connected squarely on the man's jaw, nearly lifting him out of his shoes. Dirk watched from inches away as the man's eyes rolled to the back of his head and he slumped to the floor unconscious. Guard number three took a small step back as the fighting broke out and attempted to raise the muzzle of his rifle at Dirk. Summer reacted by grabbing the shoulders of the man she'd kneed and shoving his hunched-over body towards the standing guard. The still groaning bald man swayed heavily into his taller accomplice with just enough force to offset the other man's balance. It was enough time to allow Dirk to step over the fallen guard and let go a left cross that landed a glancing blow on the gunman's temple. The dazed guard tried to counter with a braced karate kick, but Dirk's right fist was already there, mashing solidly into the man's larynx. The guard's face turned blue as he fought to take in air, and he dropped to his knees, grabbing his throat with both hands. Dirk grabbed the man's assault rifle and swung it around viciously, striking the stock against the face of the guard struggling with Summer. The blow threw the man against the back of the elevator, where he slid to the floor unconscious. Nice work, Smokin' Joe, Summer praised. Let's not wait for round two, Dirk gasped as the elevator descent slowed beneath their feet. He checked that the safety on the assault rifle was turned off, then prepared to leap out of the elevator as the doors opened. Only there was nowhere to go. As the doors slid open, the muzzles of three AK-74s were thrust in, the compensators at the end of the gun barrels poking into their faces. A security guard sitting at a bank of television monitors had witnessed the fracas in the elevator over closed-circuit video and quickly dispatched a cadre of guards in the vicinity.
Saw!
The guards yelled in Korean, their meaning perfectly clear. Dirk and Summer froze in their tracks, wondering what degree of hair triggers existed on the assault rifles pointed their way.
Dirk gently dropped his rifle to the ground, detecting a stirring in the elevator behind him. Too late, he turned to see the third guard staggering from the elevator while swinging the butt of his rifle toward his head. He tried to duck, but the gun handle was too far along its way towards the top of his skull, where it collided with a thump. For an instant, he saw a blinding light and shining stars, and through the fog, an odd glimpse of Summer's feet. But that soon gave way to a fading darkness that turned to black as the curtain closed and he crumpled to the ground in a limp heap.